This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Please put your hands together and give a very, very warm welcome to Mr. Simon Reeve and Paul Coldstein.
Pick up your,
hello.
Your birds.
Thank you. Hello. Ooh.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Goodness me, that's a lot of people. You know, I was sometimes
Afternoon.
Yeah,
afternoon.
I was trying
hello.
To.
Hello.
Sometimes thinking how you start an interview. I was coming in on the District Line, and somewhere just beyond Fulham Broadway this morning. I wonder if they're actually here in the audience. I'm looking for them feverishly now. A lady turned to her friend and says, "Oh, that Simon Reeves on. He's a tasty bit of stuff." Pen came out, I thought, this is too good. So, yes, we have, I'm sure you'll be pleased to hear, some more rugged TV screen toffee to interview now. Now, look, I've got to start. I don't know whether any of you are here on Thursday or not, but I'm sure a lot of you have seen the programme about the Nile, Leveson's Woods programme about the Nile, which he walked 3,000 plus miles of it. Mm-hmm. Simon, you flew over it in a helicopter. A bit easier, I walked a little bit.
Yes.
You did walk a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
How many of you saw the Sacred Rivers, Simon's show? Come on. Oh, that's a lot.
I'm not even looking.
It's
thank
more
you.
Over
you,
this
thank
side,
you for
but,
playing along with him.
Yeah, no, it's... I got a,
He's
you
know, had I've, several Red Bulls. I've seen, I'm just on the tee.
I've seen a lot of Simon's work. I'm sure everybody has here. And I've got to say, the Nile program for me, there was three of them, and we'll discuss them. But the Nile program fascinated me. I've spent plenty of time in and around there, and some of the things you uncovered there, it became more like reportage, a really serious journalism. I'm not saying other programs haven't been serious, but what you saw with that dam, particularly in Ethiopia, and what happens to the amount of water on the Nile, did some of that shock you? I mean, I think you called it as a huge flashpoint. This is the greatest political flashpoint possible. Did that shock you? Did you sort of leave sort of a little disturbed or?
Yes.
Yeah, I bet.
you can't help it really when you fly on, and we did fly in that instance because it was to a particularly remote bit.
Yeah.
Not the bit that Leveson walked,
I have to say.
But
sure.
You were much braver. No, I'm not claiming that. I'm just saying, if you watch both, then you get a fully rounded picture of the Nile, perhaps, maybe. But shocking, surprising, I think, more than anything. It's quite extraordinary to fly through what is apparently wilderness and then suddenly come across an almost Bond film type of industrial complex being built by mysterious Italian contractors.
It was Quantum of Solace stuff. I see.
It completely was. It really is. And you know, and what they're doing, if you actually think about it, is fairly... It's epic, of course it is. It's the sort of type of thing that we've now become capable of. Damming the Nile River, diverting the Nile River. This is what human beings can do now. We are transforming the landscape of our world.
But there was a statistic you gave about who gets to use the Nile, and it was something that no doubt we sorted out hundreds of years ago. Colonials did. And
dozens of,
what was the statistic again, that the Egyptians get to have 90-something percent of
You're
it?
You're asking me to remember a specific statistic.
Well,
that
just,
is cruel.
It's just professionalism.
Well, don't expect it here. The statistic is it leaves a fairly frightening proportion of the Nile River for Egypt. So this dates back to the time when, as you say, not hundreds of years, but scores of years ago, when Brits started drawing lines on maps and deciding
who would
do little things like get the flow of the Nile River. So we decided that almost all of it would go to Egypt, and Sudan would get just a little, and Ethiopia, where most of the water of the Nile comes from, something like 80% of the waters of the Nile come out of Ethiopia, despite our preconceptions about the place being dry, dusty, and full of famine. No, it's absolutely not. It's a really verdant place, most of it. Most of the water comes from there. They don't really get to use it. They've now got a huge population. They're becoming a bit of a power in the region.
Yeah,
they're saying, actually, you know, we'd quite like to
use
this water.
Yeah.
And Egypt for generations has even refused to discuss this at all. And has said, no, we're not even going to talk about it. And Ethiopia said, well, you're not going to talk about it. We're offering to talk. We've decided we're going to get on with it. Now, we are really talking about a serious flashpoint. Because I think for us, where it falls out of the sky, we forget the absolute fundamental importance of this pure liquid to the absolute essence of life. And in that part of the world, it's not just a case of families struggle without it, it's the countries will fail.
Well, I mean, Egypt, whatever, I think it's 92% of the people live within a kilometre.
A stone's throw, essentially.
It is literally a stone's throw. And I come back to the rivers. I'm always delighted when I pick up a magazine and I see something. Simon's done a quick interview, and I just have to pick him up on a few of these things. These are great. First of all, Simon's favourite bar. I like this. It is the, of course it is, it's the Petroleum in Almaty in Kazakhstan. Now, obviously it is. Has anyone drunk at the Petroleum in Almaty in
Kazakhstan?
Nobody's
going to admit to it, but these travellers, I'm sure they have.
Okay, that's
am I supposed to say? Am I just supposed to say
the dog and
the
ferret
dog
down
and duck in Acton? Okay, no, okay, that doesn't work when you're answering a travel questionnaire.
So, okay, that's Borat's bar there. Then, of course, shopping. Why would it be anywhere other than... You know this. This could only be, if you didn't see the name or his face at the top, you would know it was Simon. Shopping, obviously Mogadishu Market. It goes without saying. I love this. And I think the worst travel experience was picking up malaria in Gabon. He doesn't pick it up in the more normal places. I just love this. I just knew it would be you. But no, where did I pick it up? Not there. However, I did agree with you wholeheartedly. His most disappointing place he's been to. Anyone want to have a guess at that? That was Dubai. Yes. Oh, I was utterly artificially
Paul
described
isn't
it.
A fan of Dubai.
No, I am not. However, moving of another place I have not been a fan of, but I did change my tune a bit, having seen you. I think Yangtze, clearly, because we see a picture of China, and I've not been quiet in slamming on them on what they do with endangered species particularly, but I really got a feeling that you were seeing a China that either you won't, but we particularly don't see.
Yeah, I mean, you've been much more at the front line of China's rapacious demand for stuff to eat.
Yes.
On your travels and working in Africa, of course. But I've seen a fair amount of that as well. I've seen the consequences of China growing around the world. Their demand for stuff out of Australia or Southeast Asia or out of Africa as well. I hadn't done a lot of traveling there, and we'd been refused access to China several times on journeys before. We tried to travel through China following the Tropic of Cancer, and they wouldn't let us in.
Why were you refused?
I think actually it was because Kate Adey had done something rather magnificent there before us. And you know, the Chinese approach is right. We're crossed with the BBC now, so nobody comes in. Mm. But the beauty with the stuff I do is that I was able to go through. Well, so one of the I quite enjoyed it. Anyway, we went through Vietnam, and I made snide comments about how they were much more welcoming than the Chinese. But so we hadn't really travelled there before. And following the Yangtze was obviously an incredible opportunity to see this country that we're constantly being told is on the rise. Well, believe you me, it's not just on the rise. It has risen.
Yes.
And it blew me away, not just because the cities look like Blade Runner cities and made me as a born and bred Londoner feel like a hick, but also I think what really surprised me is my understanding of the Chinese really was confronted and I had a stereotype of them, I think, as being... perhaps almost the production line workers, just churning stuff out. I didn't, in truth, see them as the individuals that they are. And what I loved was that they're eccentric, they're bonkers, they're funny, they like a sing-song and a drink. They are very similar. Of course, they're similar to us, but we all deal with the stereotypes that culture gives us over the years. I love China. I think it's very easy for us to forget that the current period of history, the communist period of history, if you like, is just a small period in the history of a country and a civilization stretching over thousands of years. Yes, I totally agree with you. They are eating creatures that we desperately need to keep.
Yes, we do.
We ate a lot of those creatures hundreds of years ago. We destroyed life on our continent and others.
Primary
we
forests,
shot endlessly creatures around the world and just slaughtered them. We not chopped down our primary forests exactly as you say hundreds of years ago. Now we criticize others for doing it. It's right to. I think things are changing in China, and I really hope, you know, people are signing up for animal welfare organizations. They're getting pets. They've gone so rapidly from a sort of point of view on animal welfare, for example, which was a long way behind where we would generally be now, to somewhere sort of getting closer to. Now, it's got to change. China has got to change, and we've got to try and help and guide and suggest, etc. But ultimately, whatever China does is going to come from within, and it will have a massive impact on us all because it is huge, because it's a massive country.
It was...
Or more importantly, it's got a massive population.
Yes.
Get that in quickly, Reeve. Yes.
It was... I really enjoyed the Yangtze programs. It's very varied. I like the way Simon describes these programs. I forget which blog or newspapers, as rollicking adventures. I love that, is a sort of old-fashioned nature of it. But it's what it was. And I think a journalist I found described, essentially, to paraphrase it, Simon makes potentially boring things seem interesting, which I think is right. Did you feel you had to jump in the Yangtze River and actually swim across? Do you remember that bit where he actually got in? I was thinking, he's not going to do it. He's not. Yeah, you remember, don't you? He's not going to do it. And then I thought, oh, my God, he is. There's suddenly this pasty body about to launch himself in. Good work.
Thank you.
Encouragement, particularly towards the end, didn't you? I love that whole thing.
It definitely got encouragement. Okay, so what Paul's talking about is traveling along the Yangtze River. We're in a city in the West where Chairman Mao famously swam across. And in some pathetic attempt to emulate Chairman Mao or to just tell that story, I got into the water with local swimming club who said we would just have a little swim around. Well, it did. It was supposed to be, and that is what it said on our risk assessment that my colleagues had filled in beforehand. And I have a little swim, and there's obviously somebody in a rescue boat nearby, and the rescue swimmer in the water with me as well. You know, nothing could possibly go wrong. And yet, the current did sort of pull me out into the middle of the river rather quickly, while Craig was still fiddling around with his camera, hadn't quite got the new lens on or something like that. And I'm going, come on! And I'm trying to call back. I'm already too far from the shore. They get into the boat. They come out, by which time I'm halfway. And I thought,
I can
do this. This is all right. And then I got whacked underneath the water, which I hadn't told you, but by a big chunk of something hit me underwater.
Yes.
And that sort of spurred me on, because I thought, and then I got into the bit where the freighters were coming through, and that was a bit mad. And I don't know if I told you this the other day, but Dominic, our producer, who has to sign off on the risk assessment, he was in this other tiny little boat that had started to sink. It was filling with water, and they were bailing it out. And he was, you know, he was saying, no, stop, Simon, you must get out. Come back, it says on the risk assessment. And so I swam on, and it was completely
fine. That was the whole Chairman Mao. I mean, did it many, many times. Not wishing to denigrate your own extraordinary achievement.
Do it again with me.
But that was a sort of machismo, in the same way that sort of Putin likes to be on a motorbike naked and wrestle with animals and stuff. It's a similar sort of thing, wasn't it?
Well, it's tied in with you don't normally see your leader doing that.
Yes,
absolutely.
Yeah, that's right. You don't normally see potential leaders like Boris Johnson saying what he did yesterday, but these sort of things are unusual.
Or going on a zip wire or something like that.
But
Putin thinks he's the first person to do this macho stuff.
Of course he does.
But Chairman Mao and others have done it before, and of course kings through history did it. It was all part of building that
indeed.
Myth. But it also tells part of the story of the river. The river is such a fundamental aspect of Chinese life. It is this great, powerful, majestic, life-giving, life-taking river as well.
Yeah.
And to engage with it, to swim across it, that was what displayed his real power. And of course, for us, we've just got small streams, frankly, like the Thames flowing through, which have never caused the devastation that something like the Yangtze has. We underestimate and fail to understand perhaps the importance of rivers to civilization. And that's why traveling along them, thoroughly recommend. You know, you don't just go into a city and stay there and have a little potter around. Go to one place, do a journey, finish somewhere else. There's a lot to be said for that as a travel experience, if you like.
I'm going to just move on to the Ganges, a river I'm quite familiar with. There's something you wrote that traveling through this area of India, I'll read it, it forced me to confront my own difficult relationship with the country. I don't know whether this was almost an epiphany, but it seemed to affect you differently. How many of you have been to Varanasi here, Cher?
It's
more this side this time, now, isn't it? I mean, it is that it is an extraordinary place. And I very much enjoyed the way you approach the Western Ghats in Varanasi, because I always recall vividly 15 years ago, first time I went there, and we were put on a boat with loads of other tourists, and we went after breakfast, and I just felt like we were being intrusive. This was something remarkable.
I never felt we were being intrusive.
No,
actually.
I didn't think you were, because you went that
time.
No,
but I don't. I think life in India is often lived outdoors. It's often lived in public. There isn't this desire to hide away life and death. So birth and death, I would say. I mean, having said that, you know, there are cases, obviously, where women women are forced to hide away in villages and terrible things like that. What you're talking about when I say about the difficult relationship, almost all of the journeys I've done in India before have been, and I have travelled there quite a lot,
yes.
but they've always been outside the main touristy areas. I've never done that golden triangle that people talk about, but I've travelled all the way around the coast, I've travelled across it, I've travelled all various parts of it, but I have walked into a lot of villages in India, and for example, on one occasion, walked into a large village in India where there are people making a wooden plough by hand. There is no electricity. There is no healthcare. There is no semblance of the modern world. I think a lot of things happen in India that if they happened in China, we in the rest of the world would be knocking on Beijing's
We'd
door and protesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's unfair, and I think there are double standards about the suffering of poor people in India compared to other parts of the world. We sort of overlook it, and that is fundamentally wrong. The suffering I've seen there is worse than anywhere else in the world, in my view. It's worse than suffering and poverty I've seen in almost all of Africa outside yeah. famine zones. So that's the difficult aspect of the relationship. Of course, it's an incredible country. Of course, it's got an incredible culture and civilization. But I'm in my job, my gig is to also look for the shade as well as the light. And so we go out and we have to find those aspects that perhaps you don't necessarily get to see when you're on an adventure or a holiday there. And there is a lot of tragedy there. And there's a lot of just ludicrous things. You talk about how we approached the Ghats in Varanasi. Yeah. We went in on a boat at yeah. dawn. But I tell you, and I hope it's not too crude a little story to tell, but we had to do that approach about six times because people constantly kept coming down the banks of the as we came into Varanasi to poo in the by the river in public. And this is something that's got to be addressed there. We still have this merchant ivory, many people still have this merchant ivory view of India. And it's changed. The population has doubled while I've been alive. And that results in inevitable pressures that aren't being addressed by what is often, frankly, a very muppety leadership.
No, I'd agree. And I'm glad to see your stiffening viewpoint there as well. It's a memory I have just lastly on Varanasi. I think we've spoken about this before, that I can remember the second time I went there very, very early and just seeing in one field of view the washing over here, the burial duty there, the sort of religious duty several steps up, and the game of cricket above it. I mean, it's mind-blowing. It's an intimidating
city. You work in
city.
Frames, don't you? And I suppose we all do in many ways.
Yeah, I mean,
yours is even harder to get. Because, of course, Paul is one of our great photographers. Notice his book here, okay? One of our great photographers. So he always thinks of frames. We in telly, we can pan a camera, so we have slightly
yes,
more
yes,
freedom.
Yes, yeah, much easier. of course, you have it easy. No, good. Look, I mean, a lot of your television programs have been these sort of big journeys, you know
I
what
think
I mean?
It's all
right,
yeah.
But you have kind of almost polarized yourself into more specific programs as well. I know the repeated recently, in fact, just a few weeks ago, your coffee trail and how many of you people saw the coffee trail or the tea trail programs?
Thank you.
Still available on iPlayer, I believe. I adored the tea. I like them both, and I particularly that you're talking about in Vietnam, the number of elephants that interest me that have come down staggeringly after the war, where there were several thousand, and now there's a few dozen, because of course there's so few of them, they can't mate, they don't find each other. But
in Africa, it's prime. One of the massive things is loss of habitat.
Habitat encroachment.
As our numbers expand and we take up more of the planet, then there is less space for anything else, and that's obviously an enormous shame. But that balance, how do you look after poor people who want a bit of farmland to grow food for their families while still protecting life on Earth, as it were? That I think is one of the biggest challenges facing the entire conservation movement.
I like that, but I because I know East Africa better. I thought the tea program I did again. It was distressing. It was fascinating. I very much enjoyed the fact again that it was one of these journeys. You're seeing what we put in our pot. I just thought, but yet, I mean, you went to the Unilever thing, and it would be very easy to criticize Unilever for what they're doing when people are being paid £1 a day. But then they're saying they're getting better working rights than other ones. You looked seriously not scared, but fairly bothered. But I've been to Salgar, that sort of trucker's stop. I mean, that for me was that again. What that looked like more like Channel 4's dispatches rather than a Simon Reeve program.
I would claim that I've done every shade from the fluffiest, here's a little koala sanctuary, through to hardcore frontline stuff for telly, and you know, before getting into telly, I wrote books, and I wrote books on lots of depressing subjects.
Sorry, for those of you who don't know, Simon wrote a best-selling, New York Times best-selling book on Al-Qaeda before 9/11. So when I remember immediately changing my view on him when I first had him interview him, I thought, he's another pretty boy explorer. And then I realized that and read it and did change my view. I would ask anyone else here to do the same if you mistakenly felt the same. Please.
The point I would just make is I don't see why we have to ignore the fact that in beautiful countries there are problems. In troubled countries there is intense beauty. And I think to ignore either side of that, just for simplicity's sake, is to somehow ignore the fundamental point of humanity, which is there are ups and downs in life. This is what happens to us on our world, individually, collectively. And to ignore that aspect of the experience is just wrong. So we don't try and shy away from it. Sometimes it can be quite difficult to go from shooting one situation with children, working children, for example, in Bangladesh, who are 6 years old and they're working in a glass factory and they haven't got any shoes on, and then the next moment I'm poncing around getting involved in a wrestling match with some locals or eating some funny food. But you know, it can be a little bit tricky to navigate that and for viewers to accept it, but it is life, you know. And when we're on our travels, we will always see, you will see suffering, you will see poverty. We all have to process that individually, and we try to in the programs as well. So yeah, we do go on, you're talking about the tea trail.
Yeah.
It's a journey I shot a while ago. It's just been repeated. I think the coffee trail, actually, I think it's going out on the telly tomorrow, which is one of it.
Yes, I believe it is.
Tea trail, most of our tea comes from East Africa. I'm sure you all knew that. And so we followed where it comes from through Kenya into Uganda and had a few experiences along the way. And Salgar, which Paul is talking about, is a truck stop. Doesn't appear on any map. Thousands of people stop there overnight to get away from bandits on the road. There's loads of prostitution there, which is sort of servicing the needs of the lorry drivers and truck drivers. Obviously, they're in huge healthcare consequences as a result. Truck drivers have been, in large part, not only, but they've been a major contributory factor spreading AIDS around Africa because of the way the virus works and the way they live their lives. So that was part of what we wanted to explore and look into. And it's a very dark place.
Yeah, it is.
There's a lot of sadness there. I wasn't frightened there.
No.
I found it moving. I had that feeling, which I'm sure we've all had, where, my God, I am so lucky. So lucky with my life.
Yeah.
And look at how people are living here, and they try and retain an element of joy and love in their existence, but my God, they are living and struggling and scrabbling.
It can be humbling and uplifting at the same time. I mean, those night cameras in the... never do anyone any favours, but you did look generally sort of quite relieved to get out of there. I've accused you of this in the past, and I'm not going to do it again, but sometimes I do see programs where you find an individual genuinely a child, you know that hardship story is going to make good TV, and then you have to divorce yourself from that child. I would struggle. I don't know whether you've put your hand in your pocket sometime, but I do know there have been times in, I think it was Ethiopia and India, where you have literally had a child palmed off on you. I mean, how do you come to terms with that? Just maybe refresh.
I think what you're talking about is probably the most emotionally upsetting moments of
it was for me watching it.
Travels.
I can't begin to countenance what
I don't.
You went
I'm not. We certainly one of those instances has been on the TV.
Yeah.
But Paul's talking about times when, and I'm sure maybe some of you have experienced as well. Sorry if I'm ruining the microphone. Is it all right? But where somebody in a desperate situation has actually tried to give me their child and said, "Take I start cracking up. Just
it's hard.
It. But take my child and give it a better life." I mean, how can, if you've got a beating heart, how can you possibly not cry yourself to sleep after that? And frankly, never look at your own life the same way. How can you possibly complain about your Wi-Fi after that? I certainly don't feel able to. I think it's a reflection of the state of planet Earth, you know, and how bloody lucky all of us are that fresh water comes out of our taps, you know, and there is a lot of sadness and suffering out there. And yeah, I think that's happened in Ethiopia, it's happened in India as well, and it kills me. It absolutely does. Of course, we put our hands into our pockets and pathetically give a few, and more. We're not there as
a
charity.
I'm going to stop you for a second. It's not pathetic, all right?
Well, I disagree. No, I think it is.
Leave only footsteps, take only photographs. No, leave money. You're still going to improve
but
a little way.
Don't know. If you've gone into a village where people are making a wooden plow
by hand,
you do not just leave footprints, because you have gone in there as well-fed, 50% taller than them, 50% larger than them, Westerners, with what is clearly extremely expensive equipment.
Gamergear,
you've shown them there is another way of living. You've shown them there is wealth out there, and it can destabilize things there. You know, I've worked with colleagues, and I've had situations where in that sort of place, a village where people are making things by hand, people have come up to us and they've said, please get me out of here. Take me with you. I can do anything. I'll help you. I'll shine your shoes. I'll carry your bags. Get me out of this situation. Give me a bit of what you've got. Oh, goodness. That's an absolute killer.
I see it at the beginning of each season in Kenya. I saw at least 15 guys who'd walked 400 miles to looking for a job. I was saying how much I loathed that phrase, by the way, the photographs and footsteps. Not, I think it's the most ethically derelict. Well, let's lighten the mood a little bit. Just going back to just this Vox Pox I found on Simon. The shopping, again, the Mogadishu market. But I love this. The best thing
hang on. Hold on. The reason I said that, I reckon they must have asked me something like, where did you get your best souvenir or something like that? And I said, the best market in the world, Mogadishu market. I bought myself a Somali diplomatic passport in my own name from a bloke called Mr.
Big Beard. Yeah.
Now you tell me that is my best travel souvenir.
It's a fabulous story.
So I am going to tell that over and again to...
No, it's quite. And you mean the journalist didn't actually write it exactly as you said it? You're joking.
They attempted to turn it into more interesting copy, I'm sure.
It was extremely interesting. Look, it has piqued me. And of course, the last album he bought. You can forget Mumford.
Oh, what did I say?
This is Ethiopique, volume number 8. That would be. I have 1 to 7. I do like it. It is. Yeah,
you've got
I do
on
like
that. I can't
reading
remember
these things
that. I can't remember how that would have come out.
Yeah, of course
out.
You can't remember. But I do like the I really do, because it's such a mixed bag. It would be very difficult. You know, anyone who believes the sort of ridiculous astrological signs that you're going to meet a stranger or this or that. Simon seems to have a bit of everything, because then I read a bit more. I delve into this, because that is fluff, largely, apart from Mr. Big Beard, obviously. You know, I found some. If he was mayor, I just love this. I want walking lanes for those who don't want to dawdle in London. Nice one. I'm there with you. Also, I want something done about the Mideastern petrolhead playboys who use London as their private racetrack. Yes. I mean, I'm really enjoying this. And then, of course, I read your hero. And instead of the sort of sitting on the fence, lots of heroes, anyone who goes to work, it's Consuelo Sanchez, this extraordinary. Does anyone know who Consuelo Sanchez is? Simon, you want to say this is the lady who put down Escobar, wasn't it?
It was a sad story. Well, I spent a significant period of time trying to write a book about and with a lady called Consuelo Sanchez, who was, try and compress it down, she was the young female Colombian judge who basically took down Pablo Escobar and the Medellin cartel and became the tip of the spear in the war against the Medellin cartel. Incredible woman. She was subjected to 13 assassination attempts by the cartel after she'd been publicly identified as the lead investigator against them. And they had she was in a sort of Napoleonic era type judge in Colombia. So she was an investigative judge with a badge, and she worked undercover, and she would raid places with a elite SWAT team. One of the most extraordinary stories I've ever heard and encountered. And she came to me after 9/11, because my book, as Paul says, nobody read it beforehand, but it became a bestseller in the States. And she was living in protected custody in the States, protected by about a quarter of the State Department's agents for protecting foreign dignitaries. She was still under a permanent death sentence from the cartel. And we worked on a project together. We worked on trying to write a book about her life. And it was the last major book I wrote attempted to write for a long time, and I gave up because we tried to sell it and nobody was interested. All they wanted me to do was write more about terrorism. They said they weren't interested in South America, and it just would never sell. So it never got written. It's just sort of one of those we all have a bit of a serious professional annoyance, and that's mine. But she was, I think what was incredible about her is, you know, I'm a very cynical type, and I had stopped believing in the notion of altruism. I thought we all do stuff for selfish reasons, basically. But she put her life and her, you know, her existence in Colombia completely on the line. She was utterly selfless, dedicated, did it for all the right reasons. I've met a lot of extraordinary people, and she's right there at the top.
Yeah, and it is those people. I think, I'm sure everyone has these stories. But in my field, you know, you find the Rabinovitz Leakeys, these people who stand up for these animal rights, stand up for the local people, and that gives you the hope. Every time you get really down, you think of these utter saints. It's extraordinary. But anyway, let's move on from that, because you've got new stuff coming. Now, you've seen Simon sort of swimming in the Yangtze, doing all of these amazingly tough things.
Pottsing around, yes.
And no, I'm being serious. And I'm really taking on some tough gigs around the world. So you're obviously fascinated about what his next program is, what he's going to really put himself through. So are we going to be able to do this? Show you a bit. So
left.
Please have some sympathy for Simon's next
show. Can I just
show.
Explain first, right? Okay, so this is all Paul leading up to taking the mickey out of the fact that I've got a new series coming out in a couple of months. I take it on the chin. It's called Caribbean, all right? That's that whole thing. Obviously, I only get the crumbs from Lord Palin's table, but I do seem to have done okay. Caribbean, bit of a no-brainer. Who wouldn't want to do it? The idea is I travel all the way around the Caribbean Sea. So although it looks like a fairly small patch planet here, it's about 1 million square miles. And we went from Hispaniola, which I'm sure several of you have been to, the island divided between Haiti and Dominican Republic. And we went clockwise around the Caribbean and then up the South American and Central American Caribbean coast. So through Venezuela, Colombia. I know Paul's doing this behind me.
I'm not.
Through Honduras and Nicaragua, places like that. So most dangerous city in the world, as well as some lovely beaches. Oh, here it is.
Oh, geez, that is hard graft. Oh, no.
With its thousands of beautiful islands.
We've got to make it look good.
Incredible mainland coast, home to millions of extraordinary people. Oh. This is a vast area with a rich and brutal history.
Shut up, don't ruin it.
Some of the most dangerous.
Is that helicopter again?
It's one of the most vibrant and exciting regions on Earth.
It's the Caribbean.
Pasty bloke.
On this first leg of my journey, I travel east across the Caribbean Sea. From the island of Hispaniola.
I've just said this.
To the American territory of Puerto Rico. In the Dominican Republic, I'm picked up by the officers battling drug pushers and cartels.
That is a block of cocaine.
I come face to face with the reality of living in America's backyard.
Big bomb.
Quite peaceful and still down there. Apart, this massive bomb.
I cross one of the poorest countries in the world and get a warm welcome at a voodoo ceremony.
This is a real treasure of Haiti.
Right, come on, yeah.
Sorry about him.
No, he worked terrifically hard on that. I will be watching it, though. Yes, I will, because as ever, he doesn't just scratch the surface. We have gone on a bit long. We have a magic microphone, and we're going to have a stack load of questions, and we're going to try and get through as many as possible. So the first people who stick their hands up are going to... Whoa, straight away. Oh, look, there's three already. Did you have your hand up there? Did you? Yes, we're going to come to the young boy.
Hello there,
here.
Thanks for coming.
Hang on. Oh, you've got one already. We'll come to you
This
next.
Young gentleman has got one here.
Very quickly, absolutely marvellous. Thank you very much for everything you do. We see you sort of wandering around all these places, but what is the team that goes with you? I mean, you have 15 cameramen and all the rest of it?
Four of us travel out, basically, including me. So you've got presenter type. You've got an assistant producer who does everything, really. You've got a cameraman, one cameraman, and we've got a producer-director. But all of us do a little bit of everything. I probably do the least of anyone, no doubt. But one cameraman, and they do an incredible job. You know, 15 kilograms sometimes on their shoulders for hour after hour while I gas and bloviate, as one of them taught me. There's a good word to look up when you're applying to be a TV presenter. Bloviate away. There's not a huge crew. Fairly light footprint, but still... We try and maximise all the different types of filming that we can, and we take a load of different cameras. And sometimes, when I'm chatting away with somebody, Craig or Jonathan, who generally the cameraman I've worked with most, they'll be filming me, and then somebody else will be filming another angle with a different camera, just to sort of maximise our time, because obviously we haven't got the luxury of hanging around for weeks and weeks and weeks, because that, I'm turning my fingers, that costs this.
That costs
Thanks
us.
For the question. That costs you. Yeah, that's the point. No, we do try and bear that in mind just a little bit, you know, where your money is going to be spent. So, small team, but they're very professional.
Can we come to the young lad there?
What was your favourite adventure?
What was your favourite adventure?
Oh, that's a brilliant question. Thank you very much indeed for that. Thank you for speaking up. What was my favourite adventure? Gentleman at the front just asked. It was probably a series. I mean, they're all fantastic and amazing. And every, honest to God, every single day we're on the road when we're filming and we're having these adventures. And for me, anyway, personally, on holidays as well, I think it's the most magnificent privilege imaginable. So I'm learning stuff every day. I'm having incredible experiences every hour of every day. I love it for that. If you forced me, hand behind the back, to come up with one, I would say a series I did a while ago called Places That Don't Exist, which is all about countries that aren't officially countries. So they think of themselves as being one, but nobody will recognize them as being an official country. So they're not a member of the United Nations. They don't get to send a team to the World Cup. And they were all extraordinary. So Transnistria, which is on the edge of Europe, it's between Moldova in Ukraine, was just one of the exotic, amazing places we went to there. And just mind-blowing experiences, frankly, that I know Paul's not going to let me bloviate on about any longer. But thank you for the question.
Very good question. Next one, please. Goodness, they're all over here.
Hi, Simon.
Hello.
As part of your new hard-hitting Caribbean series, did you call into Richard Branson's Necker Island?
So gentleman here, with subtle irony, said, as part of your hard-hitting new Caribbean series, did you call into Richard Branson's Necker Island? No, we did not call into Necker Island.
Good.
We did stop off a couple of beaches, honestly.
Yeah.
Generally, just to get some really glamorous shots. So you fickle TV viewers would watch the series. It was amazing, and I know what a good gig I've got. I really do. I don't come from a travel-y background. I didn't get on a plane until I started working. I know I'm lucky to be doing this, okay? And Caribbean, I mean, I know. Just don't storm the stage in fury, okay? But we did go to, obviously, the shady bits as well, what I say light and shade, so the darker stories. You saw a little bit there about drugs, SWAT team raid, went to the most dangerous city in the world in Honduras, went into the gang wing of a prison in the most dangerous city in the world.
Yeah,
no guards, with a local bishop as guarantee of security, meeting folk who've skinned people and got tears running down their cheeks.
Don't start getting
number
sympathy,
of people.
Please.
It was very, very frightening. So the absolute extremes. I mean, what I really love about journeys and what we try and incorporate in is those extremes. That's the reality of life. You've got Seychelles near the coast of Somalia. That's where we live, and we try and incorporate those both sides into the journeys.
The composition of it was, you're just in the trailer, but it is beautiful. You're diving one moment, and the next moment you're on your face getting the full marigold treatment. I mean, it's that's good enough. Good to see you getting a bit of a kicking. We got one over here.
Yes.
Okay. I used to live in Turks and Caicos and teaching, and some of my students would replant coral because through the tourist industry, they were dumping like illegal stuff in the waters and destroying it. Did you cover any of that on your program?
Yes, we did.
Conservation.
And, you know, you're having at me about my gig. I lived in the Turks and Caicos.
Yes,
come on now. Everybody's done extraordinary things.
I'm beginning to wish we'd never brought this thing up.
You brought it up. Don't blame
me. You're right.
Okay, so yes, we covered. We didn't do coral replanting there because we have we have to try and mix it up, obviously, just in case anybody has seen previous programs. And traveling around the Indian Ocean, we filmed coral transplanting and coral regrowth there. Inevitably, it's only fairly small scale compared to the scale of the problem, compared to the destruction. It is possible to regrow. Generally, people don't. We filmed on the coral reef in the third program in the series off the coast of Honduras, which is in some ways the second largest in the world, in some ways more spectacular even than the Great Barrier Reef. But my God, our oceans have taken an absolute hammering, battering from us. We are annihilating life in our oceans. So, yes, absolutely, we incorporate that into the shows, banging away at it as much as we possibly can without hopefully putting too many people off from turning over because, you know, we want people to hear that message. But, yes, I've sampled parrotfish on coral reef, essential to the life of it. It's something we incorporate in repeatedly in this series. And thank you for reminding me and hassling me about it.
Good, we've got another one here.
Hello.
Hi. I'm just interested in, are you involved in where you go for your next programme? Who plans it? Who decides where you go to? Is it you or a producer?
Do I get to choose my gigs, this lady's asking. I don't know if you can all hear at the back. I understand the speakers are working, I'm sure. I don't get a free pass to say, you know, I'd really like to, it's getting a bit cold, and I'd love to go to the Caribbean. Yeah, it's not quite like that, but yes, I did come up with the idea for the Caribbean series. It's not rocket science. It is partly where has Mr. Palin been. It is what else has been on the telly. It is also where have
there's
I been.
There's a certain cachet, though, if Michael Palin hasn't been there, do you know what I'm saying?
No, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, doff the cap and show due respect, of course. The reality is, if somebody else has done a telly series about it, then you might not want to see it. Somebody else doing it immediately. I've got a big map on my desk. I just look at it. I think, where haven't I been? Where would make an extreme sort of adventure? It's got to be somewhere that's got a brand, if you like, that will appeal to you as viewers. So the stuff I've done, Caribbean, Indian Ocean, Australia, it is obviously designed to get your eyeballs, because not you lot, you're all lovely, but British TV viewers, they can be a bit fickle when they're flicking through. So we've got to get them watching in the first place. It's not the priority, but we have to balance it. So I get involved, I get to choose. They have started suggesting things to me now, which is obviously a great privilege as well. And if they're fantastic, then I say yes. Good. Who would not?
Good one. We're going to have one more question. Is the lady in the sort of green and grey?
Very quick one.
Fight
this
your
one.
Way
I'm
through.
Just going to bob through there. Don't worry, I'll pop
just
over.
Lob
just
the quick one.
You need very to quick. Very quick.
Quick question and maybe even a quick answer.
Oh, how much chance do you get to go home?
Thank you for that question. How much chance do I get to go home? Look, I don't look for sympathy. Honestly, I have a great gig and I'm not going off for 6 months at a time. And I have worried about coming back, and I've got a nearly 4-year-old son, and I always worry about him saying, who is this strange man in the house, etc. So generally the programmes I've made, they've been about a month away for each programme. We don't do them as 6 months away, we do them as a block. It's cheaper, frankly, to do the logistics that way, and it does mean I get to come home and see my clan. But I'm not, honestly, I've spent some years when I've been away for 6 months. Now I've got a child, obviously I want to limit that down because I love him and I like playing trains and I'm not trying to get away from home or this island even. So I still travel though because I love it. It's an incredible privilege. I learn so much. I get to have amazing experiences. Look around us here. Look at what's out there. There are a world and a planet of incredible experiences, and I would be an absolute muppet if I didn't keep saying yes until the BBC says we've got somebody younger, funnier, cleverer, better looking, etc. You know, I'll keep doing it. Well, if you're still keep having me, quite frankly, thanks for the question.
Yeah, it's a good one. If I can just sort of close up before Simon has a final say, is there's something someone in The Guardian wrote. I'm not a massive fan of the travelogue, especially the celebrity one. I honestly don't give a toss how moved such and such an actor is by The View or The Poverty and wherever. But Reeve isn't a celebrity, and this isn't just a travelogue. It's one of all of those things I mentioned which flow together, converge romantically sometimes into one story. A good one too, well told. He's good at making things that have the potential to be boring, not boring. He's also good at making things that are interesting, actually fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much,
Simon.
Indeed, Paul. That is thoroughly appreciated.
We'll be blogging and posting recordings of all the events live each day, so check back for more.